Turn to Proverbs 7 and verse 17. I'm going to cover a few more verses in the Proverbs tonight, Lord willing. We're still talking about the strange woman. And last time, you'll remember, she began to speak to the young man. And she was telling him about her bed. And she said there in verse 16, "I've decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt." And now she says in verse 17, I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. So let's look at that first part there. I've perfumed my bed. So she'd talked about in the previous verse, as I just said, how her bed looked nice. And now she's going to talk about how it smells nice. To perfume means to fill or impregnate with the smoke or vapor of some burning substance, of incense or other substance emitting an agreeable odor. It's to impregnate with sweet odor, to impart a sweet scent to. So when you perfume something, you fill the room with a sweet odor, obviously. Now it's interesting that perfuming something is not wrong. Right? It's not when she says, "I perfume my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon," that act, there's something wrong with that. She is a strange woman, and she's an evil woman, but just because she did this doesn't make it evil. Because God himself ordained that sweet-smelling perfume would be made for the tabernacle. He said in Exodus 30 and verses 34 through 36, he gave this instruction to Moses that he was to make this perfume for the tabernacle. Exodus 30, 34 through 36. It says, And the Lord said unto Moses, "Take unto thee sweet spices." I'm not sure how you pronounce that. I think it's stacked, or maybe stacty. I don't know. "Stacked, and onycha, and galbanum, these sweet spices with pure frankincense, of each shall there be a like weight. And thou shalt make it a perfume, a confection after the art of the apothecary, tempered together, pure and holy. And thou shalt beat some of it very small, and put of it before the testimony in the tabernacle of the congregation, where I will meet with thee, and it shall be unto you most holy." So these spices here, there were four of them, were to be made together into a perfume, and beat very small. So this tells me it's some kind of a powder. Probably maybe an incense. Could be an incense because they were to burn incense. And as we'll read the definitions here, some of these even talk about them being burning. When they're burnt, they emit an aroma. So stacked is a fragrant spice referred to by ancient writers, properly the finest kind of myrrh, the exudation of the living tree. Now the strange woman said that she decked her bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. So stacked, if that's how you pronounce that, and myrrh, or stacked is a type of myrrh, the finest kind of myrrh. So at least some of these things, there is some overlap in the perfume that she's using and the perfume that God had ordained, and I'll talk about that in a second. Then you have onycha. Onycha is one of the ingredients in the incense used in the Mosaic ritual. The operculum of a species of strombus or other marine mollusk, which emits a penetrating aroma when burnt. And a mollusk is like a mussel or a clam or something like that. So apparently, you take this animal and probably dry it out and beat it into a powder and burn it or something, and it makes a nice aroma, which is interesting. But I could be wrong on this, but I think purple also comes from the sea. When they made the purple garment, like Lydia was a seller of purple, that purple dye that they dyed clothes with and fabrics with, I think that comes from a sea creature too, if I remember right. It's very rare and very expensive. And then Moses was to use galbanum. Galbanum is a gum resin obtained from certain Persian species of ferula, especially from galbanaflua and rubricalis. Now, I knew galbanum came from galbanaflua. I didn't know about rubricalis, but actually, I'm just making that up. I'd never heard of any of those words prior to looking them up in the dictionary. But I want you to notice that that was a resin. So galbanum is a resin, and we'll have reason to make reference to that again here in a second. And then we have frankincense. This is the fourth spice that Moses was to make this perfume for the tabernacle for. Frankincense is an aromatic gum resin yielded by trees of the genus Boswellia, used for burning as incense. Oblabanum, occasionally the smoke from the same. We're all familiar with frankincense, if not personally familiar. We've all heard of it because, why have we heard of it?
Christmas.
Yes, because, yep, because the wise men brought to Christ myrrh, frankincense, and gold. Yes. Frankincense is also a essential oil and quite costly, and people use it. I mean, they use it today for various things. I don't know if I've ever smelled it or not.
Yes.
I can't. Have I? Okay. Did I like it?
No.
Okay. I can't remember even smelling it. So
in the bathroom.
It must not have made a good impression on me.
I have some at home, and I use it. It looks like a little tiny rock.
Oh.
And you heat it over a candle flame, and it does naturally burn, but it turns black.
Mm.
And I love the smell of it, and it seems to help my sinuses.
Mm. Mm. Oh, that's interesting. Now, it's possible, I can't prove this, but it's possible the strange woman might very well have been trying to sanctify her filthy bed by perfuming it in imitation of the perfuming of the tabernacle of old. Because after all, she is a religious woman, right? She has peace offerings with her this day she'd paid her vows. Now, she wasn't using the same ingredients as Moses, not all of them anyway, but she was using myrrh and aloes are resins, so there is some similarity, and I'll define aloe here in a minute and show you that it's a resin, and some of these other things that Moses was using were resins as well. So there was a little bit of similarity there anyway. If she was trying to imitate what Moses was supposed to do in the temple, then she's going to be in bigger trouble than she's already in. Because if you look in verse 37, if you didn't turn from it, in Exodus 30 and verses 37 and 38, the Lord continues here. He says, "And as for the perfume which thou shalt make, ye shall not make to yourselves according to the composition thereof. It shall be unto thee holy for the Lord. Whosoever shall make like unto that, to smell thereto, shall even be cut off from his people." And we know being cut off from his people means to be killed or put to death. So that was a serious offense. That was a big deal. You didn't look up the ingredients that Moses used to make his perfume and make your wife some, because you're going to be put to death for that. The Lord, he likes the holy and the profane kept separate. You don't use holy things for profane things. Profane meaning non-religious. Now, smells have a strong effect on a man's mood, or in people's moods in general, and it is true that perfume rejoices the heart. If you look in Proverbs 27 and verse 9, certain perfumes rejoice the heart anyway. Certain perfumes are offensive to the nose, at least to my nose, and especially when they're put on way too heavily. There's, you know, I'm sure we've all probably walked within 100 yards of a woman where we thought we had to have a gas mask on if you were downwind from her. Or a man, for that matter. Men are just as guilty of it sometimes. I mean, I've seen men just pile it on. Like, I don't know who they're trying to attract.
Because I get allergic reactions to them. I had to leave work once.
Oh, yeah.
He came in wearing such...
Oh, yeah.
Like, my eyes were swollen shut by the time
really?
I got home.
Oh, my. Yeah.
But don't you think that back then, these were so much more wholesome and real... And this stuff that everybody's, you know, sneezing and getting stuffed up from now is just because it's the junk we have now.
Yeah.
No, that this stuff was really very smeller friendly.
Yeah. Yeah, that probably is the case. And it would have been extremely expensive, so you weren't putting 10 pumps on, and probably not anyway. But in Proverbs 27 and verse 9, says, ointment and perfume rejoice the heart, so doth the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. Ointment and perfume, both, they both put off a nice aroma, a nice odor, and they do make people happy. So this is probably why the young, or why the woman is trying to use this to entice the young man, because there is something about a good-smelling woman. Then she says she has perfumed her bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. So let's look at those three things. Myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. These are all spices which women use to attract men, and I can actually prove this to you in the Bible. Look at Song of Solomon 4 and verse 14. And of course, there's nothing wrong with a woman using these spices to attract a man, if it's her husband, or if she's single and he's single, or something like that. The problem is not the spices that are used, it is who is using them for whom. That's the problem. And that's the case usually with most things in the Bible. It's not normally what is done, it's who is doing it and to whom it is being done.
What the purpose of the person is.
And what the motivation is, yes, that also comes into play. Sorry about that. There we go. I just killed an ant and then flicked it onto her Bible, so instead of mine. Okay, anyway. Song of Solomon 4:14. So this is Solomon's love letter back and forth with his wife, one of them anyway, one of the wives, that is. And so then this is speaking of her, spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, and all the trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices. So this is what his wife is perfuming herself with. And if you'll notice, all of the things that the strange woman is using, she's using myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon, and other ones as well. So myrrh is a gum resin produced by several species of... I'm just going to skip those. It is myrrh used for perfumery and as an ingredient in incense. Also, medicinal uses in medicinal use is the tincture made from this. And then the dictionary... a lot of times it was definitely heavily influenced by the Bible. It says an early use almost always with reference to the offering of myrrh by the Magi of our Lord. Magi were the wise men.
To our Lord.
To our Lord, yes. Myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Aloe is not like aloe vera plant. That's what I normally think of when I think of aloe, but that's not what aloe is here. Aloe is the fragrant resin or wood of the agaloc, derived from species of two East Indian genera. And then it gives us a couple of scientific words there, naming those two species. So this is actually a type of, apparently, tree. Comes from a tree, comes from wood. So probably not the aloe plant that we think of. And then cinnamon. Cinnamon is the inner bark of an East India tree, dried in the sun in rolls or quills. We've all seen those before. Mm-hmm. And used as a spice. It is of a characteristic yellowish-brown color, brittle, fragrant, and aromatic, and acts as a carminative and restorative. So this one is edible and...
fragrant.
What's the
medicinal?
Well, no, where you can smell it.
Fragrant.
Edible.
Oh.
Fragrant. There's another word I was thinking of.
Potent.
No. Arable. Arable would be the ear. Visible is the eye.
Odoriferous. Smellable.
Yeah, smellable, but that's not... I was thinking of something more sophisticated than that, but anyway. But, so anyway, you can eat it or smell it is what I was trying to say. Now, myrrh is a perfuming spice that's fit for kings. So this is some pretty special stuff. If you look in Song of Solomon 3, 6 through 7, this is speaking of King Solomon here. It says, "Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant. Behold his bed, which is Solomon's. 80 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. So Solomon's bed probably smelled like myrrh, because he smelled like myrrh. He perfumed himself with myrrh, and wouldn't surprise me if he perfumed his bed with it as well. Nothing wrong with perfuming your bed with myrrh. Just this woman's up to some evil designs doing it. Look in Matthew 2, verse 2. Myrrh is a spice suitable for kings. This is why the wise men gave it to our Lord, who was the King of the Jews, the King of Kings, and Lord of Lords. Matthew 2 and verse 2, saying, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him." And here's what they bring to him in verse 11. "And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh." So this would have been a very costly perfume, I assume. Gold certainly is costly, and frankincense, and I assume myrrh is the same way, fit for a king. So these are expensive spices, and they would help to deceive the young man into thinking that this woman's not a trashy, cheap woman, but an affluent woman of means. Because after all, she's got myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon that she's perfumed her bed with, and it's carved up. It's got this really nice, ornate bedposts that have all this, skillfully crafted carvings on them, and it's adorned with tapestry and carved works and fine linen of Egypt and all these things. She really is making herself look like she is a classy woman. He apparently doesn't know otherwise yet, but he should be figuring it out very quickly. Now, I mentioned this last time, but there's actually some horrors. If you turn to Ezekiel 16:31, some of them actually try to buy men with gifts, or in this case, luxurious accommodations. I've read it to you last time, but I'll read it to you again. Ezekiel 16:31-33. This is basically exactly what this woman's doing. "In that thou buildest thine eminent place in the head of every way, and makest thine high place in every street, and hast not been an harlot, in that thou scornest hire." She's not asking to get paid. "But as a wife that committeth adultery, that taketh strangers instead of her husband, they give gifts to all whores, but thou giveth gifts to all thy lovers, and hirest them, that they may come unto thee on every side for thy whoredom." This is pretty much what this woman's doing here. She's trying to buy him, if not with money, but she's trying to buy him. She's got peace offerings with her. She's got some food. She's got a really nice bed, and it smells nice, and it looks beautiful. Right, so she's really trying to entice him with her means here. And the very thought of an ornately adorned bed perfumed with sweet aroma would be very appealing to a lot of men. Right, so she's really turning up the tantalization here to try to get him to come in. Turn to Proverbs 7:18. So the strange woman just got done telling this young man that she'd perfumed her bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon, and now she goes in for the kill. At this point, she's been talking it up. She's been giving him reasons which would entice him, but now she just comes flat out and tells him, all right, let's do it. Verse 18, "Come, let us take our fill until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves." She's skilled at the power of persuasion, because she didn't start out with just walking up and said, hey, come to my place, right? She walks up, she makes it look like she's a good woman, she flatters him a bit, she tells him about how nice her place is, and then she, goes in with the direct move. She was a lot more skilled than that Potiphar's wife. Because Potiphar's wife pretty much just came to Joseph and said, lie with me. I mean, that was the extent of her courtship there. So this woman's laid all the groundwork to seduce the young man now. First, she has appealed to his lust of the eyes with her immodest attire. Now, before we, you just keep your finger there in Proverbs chapter 7 and turn over to 1 John 2:16. We're going to see here, here are the three things, the three ways in which a man is enticed. This is how our Mother Eve was enticed by the devil. He appealed to these same three things, and this is how the devil or any sinner will try to get into us to make us follow our lusts. 1 John 2 and verse 16 says, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." So I want you to remember those three things. Just keep your finger there, and let's look at how this woman appeals to all three of those things. First of all, the lust of the eyes with her immodest attire. Verse 10, "And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart." That's appealing to the man's sense of sight. Next, she grabs him, kisses him, and tells him of her finely decorated and perfumed bed, appealing to his lust of the flesh. Verse 13, "So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him," and then down in verses 16 and 17, "I've decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon." Lust of the flesh. Gives him a kiss, and then appealing to his fleshly desires of smell and, you know, things like that. And then she flatters him, appealing to his pride of life. Verse 15, "Therefore came I forth to meet thee diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee." So that would definitely appeal to his pride, because here he is, just, you know, some young man, probably never had a good-looking woman of means ever talk to him before, and all of a sudden she walks up and says, "I've been looking for somebody just like you. I finally found you. I am so thank the Lord. I just got home from church, and I was praying for a good godly man, and along you walked, and I just ran out and figured I'd come out and talk to you." Appeals to his pride of life. So having thoroughly tantalized his carnal nature, and even tried to appeal to his spiritual nature, you remember verse 14, "I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows." She's done all this to weaken his resistance, and now she goes in for the kill. She says, "Come." Up until now, she's been trying to persuade him. Now she moves from persuading to commanding. "Come" means, in its most literal sense, it expresses the hitherward motion of a voluntary agent to move towards, approach. In other words, come in, come towards me, come to my house. Now, it's interesting that in Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 5, wisdom here, personified as a woman, bids men to come unto her. Proverbs 9, 5, "Come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine which I have mingled." The strange woman does the same thing, right? See, she mimics the wisdom, the personification of wisdom here, the godly woman who bids men to come to into the church and partake of the Lord's Supper, in other words, bread and wine. And we'll talk about that when we get there here in a while. She likewise bids him to come. "Let us take our fill of love." She invites the young man to come into her house and get all the quote-unquote love that he wants, because she said, "Take our fill of love." Fill is a full supply of drink or food, enough to satisfy want or desire. Now, she is perverting the meanings of words here, because she says, "Come, let us take our fill of love." What she's referring to by love is not love, right? She's referring to lust. That's what fornication and whoredom is. It's lust, not love. Look at Romans 1 and verse 24. There's a lot of fools out there that claim to love each other, love his girlfriend or love her boyfriend, and they're doing nothing of the sort. They are committing sin, and that is not an act of love. Romans 1 and verse 24, "Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies between themselves." These are people that rejected God first of all, worshiped the creature more than the creator, and then God gave them up to all these various things. He first gave them up to false worship, then he gives them up to fornication, then he gives them up to sodomy. And notice there, it's called lust. The uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts to dishonor their bodies between themselves. And also look in 1 Thessalonians 4, 3 through 7. Paul says, "For this is the will of God, even your sanctification, that ye should abstain from fornication," that's sex outside of marriage, "that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel," that is his body, "in sanctification and honor, not in the lust," so there you go, fornication is lust, not love, "not in the lust of concupiscence, even as the Gentiles which know not God, that no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any matter, because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also have forewarned you and testified, for God hath not called us unto uncleanness, but unto holiness." So when she says, let's take our fill of love, she's using the wrong word. Let us take our fill of lust is what she really should have said. Because love is the keeping of God's commandments toward God and toward our neighbor. If you want to know if you love somebody, see if you keep God's commandments. If you keep God's commandments, you love God. And if you keep God's commandments towards other people, you love them. And some of those commandments are rebuking your neighbor and correcting people and hard things that don't feel like love. Spanking your children, right? That's an act of love. "He that spareth his rod hateth his son. He that loveth him chasteneth him betimes." So sometimes the things that we think feel like love are actually not love. And the things that don't feel like love are love. If you're doing what God says towards somebody, you love them, whether it feels like an act of love or not. 2 John 1 and verse 6. He says, "And this is love, that we walk not," or "that we walk after his commandments. This is the commandment that ye have heard from the beginning." "This is the commandment that, as ye have heard from the beginning, ye should walk in it." So this is love, that we walk after his commandments. He just defines what love is, walking in God's commandments. That's true love. And then just go back a page to 1 John 5, 2 through 3. It says, "By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments." Right there you go. How do you know you love God's children? When you keep God's commandments. So you may have never told somebody in this church that I love you. But if you keep God's commandments in general, toward God, toward them, you do love that person. Because that's how we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments.
And speaking of love, you have 1 Corinthians 13 that talks about what charity, love, is.
Yes, that's right. Which is being patient and kind and keeping God's, rejoicing in the truth, mm-hmm. rejoicing not in iniquity, believeth all things, right? All those things are acts of love. Fornicators do not love each other. They merely lust after each other. And now it goes from the sublime to the ridiculous. "Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning." She entices him with exaggerated promises. Until the morning. Until means reference to time. It means onward till, a time specified or indicated, up to the time of an action, occurrence, etc. So she is suggesting that they can take their fill of, quote, love, unquote, from the evening, remember she met him in the evening, in the morning, in the black and dark night, from the evening up until the time of the morning. Okay, only in movies and romance novels do people make love all night long. That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of.
I've heard someone do it like for 3 days.
Well, it's like some freak of nature or something. That's crazy.
Because they have been apart for a long time. So it took them 3 days.
I don't know, that sounds like folklore to me.
3 days.
Yeah, I believe it when I see it.
Why would you want to see
it? I don't want to see it.
Poor choice of words.
Yeah, right. Only an inexperienced fool would be excited by such a ridiculous proposition, making love all night long. In the real world, men fall asleep after sex and don't wake up for a long time. And I have Bible for this. Song of Solomon 2, 3 through 7.
Do we need Bible?
No, but, you know, we prove all things. Hold fast to that which is good. Song of Solomon 2, 3 through 7. As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. I'm not going to expound that. You can just think on that and figure it out for yourself. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Stay me with flagons, comfort me with apples, for I am sick of love. She's lovesick. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me. You can probably figure out what's going on there. I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up nor awake my love till he please. So this is referring to lovemaking here. And how does it end? He's sleeping, and don't wake him up until he's ready to get up. It's going to be a while. Look at chapter 3, 4 through 5. It says, it was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up nor awake my love till he please. So there's the mouth of two witnesses. So by this point, the young fool is too excited to be thinking rationally, though. He just thinks, take our fill of love until the morning. That sounds amazing to me. You can tell he's inexperienced. Because any man that wasn't would say, give me a break. And that's absurd. And then she says, let us solace ourselves with loves. To solace means to cheer, comfort, console, to entertain, or recreate. So here the strange woman shows her cards with this comment. Because she says, let us solace ourselves with love. And solace means, at least in part, to entertain or recreate. So this is not exactly love going on here, right? Her enticement of him is for the purpose of entertainment and recreation, not for true marital love and intimacy. This is a deception, because fornication will only afford fleeting joy afterwards, to be followed by shame, disappointment, regret, disease, poverty, and more. Could even be death. Let's just look at a few verses that we've already been over. Proverbs 5, 8 through 14. Proverbs 5, 8 through 14. We heard how the adulteress makes things sound like they'll turn out. Now let's see how they actually will turn out. Proverbs 5, 8 through 14. Remove thy way far from her, and come not nigh the door of her house, lest thou give thine honor unto others, and thy years unto the cruel, lest strangers be filled with thy wealth, and thy labors be in the house of a stranger. And thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed, and say, how have I hated instruction, and my heart despised reproof, and have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined mine ear to them that instructed me. I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation and assembly. So there you have the man that goes into the strange woman, and he loses his honor, he loses his wealth, he loses his health, his marriage, if he had one prior to that. He loses a lot. Could even lose his life. Let's look in verses 20 through 21 of chapter 6. He says, my son, keep thy father's commandment, and forsake not the law of thy mother. Bind them continually upon thine heart, tie them about thy neck. I wanted Romans chapter 6. I knew that didn't look right. Romans chapter 6. All I saw. Yes, that is good advice. I just saw 6:20 and jetted over there. Romans chapter 6. Verses 20 through 21. For when ye were the servants of sin, ye were free from righteousness. Right, there's your free will. Free from righteousness. What fruit had ye then in those things whereof ye are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. Yes, the fruit of sin is being ashamed and ultimately ends up in death. The wages of sin is death.
So
So you should be ashamed of your former sins.
Yes.
And not brag about them.
Right, exactly,
but
yes.
Say you don't brag about getting drunk when
right.
you were younger.
Right, exactly. I that just really grates on me. I hate that when people do that.
When people do what? Say that again.
Oh, just talk and boast about when they used to get drunk when they were younger and
yeah,
things like that. And
yeah.
Boasting about sin instead of being ashamed of it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that takes care of verse 18. Turn to Proverbs 7:19. This will be the last verse for tonight. Still talking about the strange woman, and this is her appeal to this foolish young man. She said in verse 18, "Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves." And then she goes on to explain why she's able to do this. She says, "For the goodman is not at home. He is gone a long journey." Let's look at that first part. "For the goodman is not at home." A goodman's an old word that we don't use today. It is used several times in the Bible. It means, it's what's sometimes used as a vague title of dignity or a respectful form of address. It is the master or male head of a household or other establishment, the host of an inn, the keeper of a prison. You remember when Jesus told the disciples to go to the man's house and say that we're going to prepare to make ready the Passover here. And it says there that they went to the goodman and they talked with the goodman. He was the keeper of the house. It's also a householder in relation to his wife, a husband, and that's how it's being used here with the strange woman. So when she says the goodman is not at home, she's referring to her husband. He's not at home. So up to this point, it would have been possible for the young man to think that this woman was not married, because there was really no indication that I can see prior to verse 19 to tell him that she's married. She does have her own house, but it's possible she could have been a wealthy woman. Maybe she could have been a widow or something and been left an inheritance, or could have been like Lydia, seller of purple or something, and had wealth. Lydia had a large house where she had people to come in, come into. So there's nothing guaranteeing that she is a married woman at this point, up until this point. Any fool should have known that she was a whore, though, based on her words and actions, though he might not have known that she was an adulteress, right? There's no way that you couldn't have known she was a whore just by the way she was dressed and the way she was talking and those kind of things and how forward she was. But it's possible that she was just, you know, an unmarried harlot. But now there's no doubt that she is an evil, unfaithful woman, because she just told you, the goodman's gone. My husband's away. Right? She tells him that the goodman is not at home. This is obviously a suggestive comment, right? What else does that mean? Except when you meet a man and you start flirting with him and you say, "Oh, my husband's not home." What does that mean? I mean, you know, that should be a red flag. If the goodman would have known what was going to happen when he was gone, he likely would have stayed at home and not suffered the wife thief to enter his house, if you catch what I'm talking about here in Luke 12:39. Jesus said, "And this know, that if the goodman of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not have suffered his house to be broken through." If he would have known a thief was coming, he wouldn't have gone to sleep. He would have been watching and waiting, and he wouldn't have allowed the guy, the thief, to come in and steal his possessions. Well, likewise, the goodman of the strange woman's house would have stayed home, and he wouldn't have allowed that wife thief to come in.
Well, it seemed as if he wasn't a wife thief, because she invited him.
Well, she goes willingly, but yeah, he's still a thief. He's still taking another man's wife, even if she's does it voluntarily.
Even if she's initiating it.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you guys used to say with the basset hound, if a thief came in, he would leave with him. I mean, he's still a thief if he steals your basset hound, even if the hound goes willingly,
yeah.
Right? She says, "He is gone a long journey." Now, to alleviate any concern of getting caught, she assures him that her husband won't be back for a while. Not only is he not at home, he's gone a long ways away, and he's not going to be back. And she says that in the next verse. We'll get to that. Whereas if this wasn't enough to entice the young man to not worry about the husband being gone, the next verse will definitely cinch that up. The fact that the woman would commit adultery as soon as her husband leaves on a trip should have been ironclad proof that she was an evil woman. Even a fool should have known to run from any woman who would do such a thing. But at this point, see, the guy, he's just not thinking anymore, if he ever was thinking. He certainly isn't thinking now. He's all excited, and all he's thinking about is what's coming next. And, I mean, after all, there's even hardly any chance of getting caught now because her husband's not even home, and he's gone, and why not?
Nobody will know.
Nobody will know, except Solomon, and then he wrote it down for the whole world to know about it.
Yep.
So next time we'll look at verse 20, where she talks about how he's gone and taken a bunch of money with him, and he's not going to be home for a long time. Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.